This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. All presidential campaigns are interesting and combative, but this year's race is shaping up to be one that is unlike anything we've witnessed in recent memory. Voters are frustrated and angry, and that is being reflected in the polls, in the candidates, in what they're saying on the stump, and in how the country is reacting. Media coverage tends to focus on the personalities involved and on who's ahead in the latest polls. Analysis of what's being said sometimes takes a back seat in this political climate. The question becomes, what difference would it make if we did a better job? After all, the voters seem to have gravitated to candidates who appear just as angry and frustrated as we seem to be. We don't appear terribly interested in whether or not those candidates are particularly presidential. In fact, appearing unpresidential may be a plus in this election year. It looks as though what voters want are quick and easy solutions. But is that what they really want? Really? Is that what voters are really thinking? NPR wants to know, and they are partnering with stations across the country to find out. Charlotte Talks has joined in that effort, and today we've invited four of our listeners to share their opinions. They, or some of what they say, may end up on other NPR programs later this week as part of that effort. Before we begin our conversation, let's start with a piece from NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Because the mood of voters is one of the most important political factors in any election year, she took a look at what's causing voters to feel anxious, frightened, and angry.
You can't talk to voters this year without hearing some pretty powerful emotions, and all the candidates are trying to show they get it. For Republicans like Marco Rubio, it's President Obama's fault.
And a president that on 10 occasions around the world has apologized for America. Apologized. And this is why people are so frustrated. This is why they're so angry. That's why this election's played out so differently.
On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' angry tirades have found a receptive audience.
This campaign is sending a message to the billionaire class. Yes, we have the guts to take you on.
Hillary Clinton has talked herself hoarse, explaining that she takes seriously the fears and insecurities of ordinary voters.
They're worried that they're going to be left behind while the people on the top, the guys who always get ahead, keep taking, leaving very little for anybody else. There's a lot of worry.
And no one has identified with or stoked voters' anger better than Donald Trump.
I will gladly accept the mantle of anger. Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief.
There are lots of good reasons voters are so ticked off this year. Number one, says former White House aide Bill Galston, is the absence of the kind of broadly shared economic growth that makes the American dream possible.
When you consider the fact that household incomes are still thousands of dollars below where they were at the end of the Clinton administration, people have gone a long time without making a lot of progress, and they know it. They're feeling it, and they're not very happy about it.
Another big factor is terrorism. Whether or not you think ISIS poses an existential threat to the United States, after San Bernardino, there was no question that the war on terror has come back home, and that's scary. Then there's demographic change, says Harvard political scientist Daniel Allen, who points out that 2014 was the first year the majority of American kindergartners were minorities.
So we're only a dozen years away from majority-minority voting cohorts entering into our voting ranks. So in other words, in some parts of the country in particular, there's just a sort of incredibly durable tradition of white political and social control. And that demographic transition is forcing to a head the question of what happens now.
This is why immigration has become such a flashpoint, particularly in the Republican primaries. Professor Roberto Serro is an immigration expert at the University of Southern California.
One of the most illustrative things that has happened this year was in the way that Donald Trump switched from Mexicans to Muslims almost instantaneously.
It was a simple pivot after San Bernardino. Terrorism and labor migration became one thing.
And what that tells you is that it's not specific immigrants. It's not even necessarily immigration itself. But this becomes the vehicle to touch people's anxieties about a whole bunch of other matters.
This year, immigration became all wrapped up in people's anxieties about jobs, terrorism, and the failure of government to perform basic functions like policing the border. Exacerbating all these anxiety-producing factors is a gridlocked political system that can't seem to solve big problems no matter which party has control. And here, Republicans are angry at their own party's leaders in Washington in a way Democrats just aren't, says conservative analyst Henry Olson, author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party.
And they've been listening to politicians who have been telling them for decades now that government can and ought to shrink quickly. And they think that when Republicans are elected, that that's what Republicans got elected on. So they are angry for things that they've been told they can have, but most people in politics know they really can't.
Voters in both parties are angry at elites. But just like everything else this year, Democratic and Republican populists are pointing their pitchforks at two very different targets. Again, Bill Galston.
For the Republicans, the anti-elite focus is on government and professional experts of all kinds. And for the Democrats, and especially the more left-leaning Democrats, the focus is on economic and financial elites.
And it's not clear, says Galston, which candidates will benefit most from all that angry anti-elitism when voters finally start going to the polls next month.
Elections serve a number of very important functions, and one of them is to hold up a mirror to society. We learn something about who we are and what we're feeling and what we want through the electoral process. And a lot of things that are beneath the surface come to the surface during the intensity of electoral combat.
And those feelings are defining the 2016 elections. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
So let's talk to some local voters about all of this. Sitting around our voter roundtable this morning, we have two independents, a Democrat and a Republican, to help us dissect the campaign, the candidates, and most importantly, the issues. Josh Fahey is in his mid-30s. He's an independent and conservative whose politics lean libertarian. He's socially liberal and usually votes Republican. A copywriter in the advertising industry, he says he's watched most every debate and is not happy with any candidate. Are you watching tonight?
I don't know if I'm going to watch tonight. I might need to catch up on some sleep.
Late night last night with the Panthers. Eh? Amber Logan is in her mid-40s. She works in the real estate industry and is part of a mother's group that encourages civic engagement. A Democrat, she says she is changing her affiliation to independent so she can vote in primaries and have more impact on a local level, but she still identifies as a Democrat. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Bob Harrison is a retired teacher who has a wide variety of employment experiences, including being a former truck driver, former builder, lifelong activist, and a 60s radical. His words, he is a registered independent and is unhappy with both parties. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, good morning, Mike. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Duncan Wilson is a financial planner and attorney who has been a registered Republican since the age of 18 in his early 30s. He says he's tired of the GOP at the moment because it has transitioned from the Goldwater-Reagan Party with the solid intellectual roots of Adam Smith to a party that is now very reactionary and soundbite-based. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thanks, Mike.
Let me begin with a question that whole piece we just listened to circulated around, and that is anger and frustration. Are all of you feeling something of that? Ladies first. Amber, are you angry and frustrated?
I am not angry and frustrated. I am actually more energized than ever. I feel like we're living at a time where we really have an opportunity to really decide how our country is going to go, where a lot of people are having a lot of important conversations. Demographics are changing, and so I am neither angry nor frustrated. I'm actually very excited.
Josh?
I don't know if anger is the right word, but it is definitely frustrating, and I feel like there's nothing we can do, almost. It's just so complicated of a problem and a process that, you know, nothing seems to work. So I'm not very excited about anybody because I don't really think anybody can do all that much different.
What do you want? Well, we'll come back to that. I was going to ask you, what do you want to get done? But we'll come back to that. Duncan.
I don't think anger is the right word, but frustrated definitely is the right word.
Over?
How insulated Washington is and how disconnected they seem to be from all the rest of the country.
Meaning? What are they missing in your personal life? What are they missing about your life that they could fix if they wanted to?
The fact that nothing ever gets done. The fact that we're spending much, much more than we bring in, that we keep running a deficit. We act like running a deficit is completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that the deficit can grow and grow and it's fine. The national debt can double in 8 years and nobody's talking about it. Nobody seems to care. And that we have all these things that we could do and should be doing. And instead, both sides just yell back and forth at each other. And that's it. That's all that ever happens.
Bob.
Well, I think I can agree with all the comments that have been made so far. I'd invite anyone to take a sheet of paper and a pencil and just write down the following six numbers or letters. The first one would be a dollar sign. The second one would be a Y. The third one would be another dollar sign. The fourth would be a T. The fifth would be an E. And the last would be an M.
System.
System. With dollar signs where instead of the S's. We unfortunately, it is frustrating. Like Amber, I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful, but it is terribly frustrating because we are in a pickle. We're letting the foxes guard the hen house, and we're asking them to make the changes, and they are not up to the task.
But didn't we set it up that way? Didn't the voters decide they were angry 4 years ago? They were angry 8 years ago. Some people voted for hope and change. Others voted for obstructionism to hope and change. And we got exactly that. Didn't we ask for this?
I think if there were more than two options, we would choose something better than those two.
What would the third option be?
A normal human being.
Adults.
If you go to Congress and if you actually manage to lose your House election, you go and get paid $1 million a year to be a lobbyist. Losing a House race as an incumbent sounds great. So they have very little motivation, and the House races are so gerrymandered, you're not going to lose anyway.
Well, Duncan, you mentioned the national debt and the never-ending open pocketbook that we seem to have access to. Republican candidates talk about that all the time, and yet they launched the wars that we're in that cost a fortune. They're blaming President Obama for a weak foreign policy and point to illegal immigrants taking Americans' jobs and services. Democrats are blaming the fat cats, the top 1%, for not giving people raises and making sure that the society and the tax system only works for them. Who's right? Ever?
You know, the challenge that I have is that I feel like it's all really, really complicated. I just feel that when we look at all these things, it's hard to simplify it and boil it down to who's right and who's wrong, because I really honestly believe that there's a little bit of right and wrong to be shared with everyone. I feel like the country has always been really complicated, and so when we oversimplify it, then we can get very reactionary.
Is that part of the problem, that people are frustrated because they want quick, easy solutions to complicated problems and nobody seems to be able to deliver that because it can't be delivered, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely think that that's what, you know, people feel. We also just have gone into, I think with the changing media landscape, we've gone into areas where everybody can go and read what they think already all the time. And so we kind of live in these echo chambers of my ideas. And so it's become very all or nothing politics. And we think it's got to be this way, or the other guy thinks it's got to be the other way.
Is compromise a bad word? Bob, quickly.
No, compromise is really, it used to be said that politics is the art of compromise. And compromise has gone out the window. All we have is spin. You're talking about Obama and criticism of Obama. If Obama found a cure for cancer this morning, he would be accused of putting doctors out of work this afternoon by the Republicans.
We come back, we'll talk about foreign policy. We'll talk about national defense and more. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting The Importance of Being Earnest, an Oscar Wilde comedy. Two bachelors lead double lives to gain the attention of a woman they both desire. Now through February 7th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Relationship violence is getting new attention, especially on college campuses, and one nationally known expert has spearheaded massive efforts aimed at prevention on college campuses nationwide. UNC Charlotte, by the way, is part of that effort, and now the CDC is getting involved in evaluating the effectiveness of campus programs to reduce violence. That expert I referred to, Dr. Ann Coker, will outline the problem for us, along with some solutions, on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, scientists say global temperatures in 2015 were the hottest on record, smashing the 2014 record. What the warming of the planet could mean for weather patterns, climate change, and hitting global temperature targets.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with a Charlotte Talks voter round table. We have four people here of different political persuasions. Josh Fahey is an independent-leaning Republican. Amber Logan is a Democrat who is registered as an independent so she can vote on the other side and spoil the election, I guess. Bob Harrison is an independent, and Duncan Wilson is a Republican, although he's not very happy with the GOP at the moment. Let's talk about national defense. Republicans always want to increase our military budget. Donald Trump, in that cut we heard in the Mara Liasson piece, said that our military is a disaster. Yet we spend more than, I think, than the top eight countries behind us combined on our military. Is our military strong enough, well-equipped enough to defend us, to defend the continental United States and our interests abroad?
Yes. We have, what, 11 carrier groups? Now, granted, we're the big guys on the block, so we have to have the biggest one because we defend Japan. We defend South Korea. We defend a lot of countries that theoretically really could defend themselves. So just naturally, we're going to have the biggest military. We've got a real big lead right now, but we've always got to be ready because China is kind of waking up.
Yeah.
So we're going to have the biggest military.
So do you think that we overspend on the military, or do we spend just about the right on the military? Is the military a disaster?
I think we overspend, and I think if you look at the wars we end up fighting, we put a lot of money into conventional weaponry and armies, and we are fighting very unconventional enemies, and it's just, you know, pouring money down the drain, and we do it over and over and over, and so I believe in having a strong military. I think we overspend on it, and I think we give a lot to, you know, defense contractors.
Josh is absolutely correct. We're fighting. It's said that we're always fighting the last war. We're still stuck in the last century in terms of our military, in terms of the way we look at the world, in terms of our foreign policy. We need to move into the 21st century, recognize that we're not going to be having conventional wars with China, or conventional wars with anyone, for that matter. We have the strongest military on the face of the earth. We saw that when we invaded Iraq. I mean, we certainly are very capable. Have we moved into the 21st century? I don't think we have, and I think we need to have a long conversation on that.
And you echo that sentiment, don't you?
I think part of the reason there's no conventional land wars anymore is because we're so powerful, that if somebody starts a land war, we will end it quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think we are moving in the right direction, but from drones, which I have a lot of concerns about, but drones are a part of the new world of warfare. I think that we get the most bang for the buck in areas where I think we probably spend the least amount of money. If you look at the F-35 program, the Joint Strike Fighter, there's so much waste in that program. So I think we're spending a lot of money.
And the military hates it.
Nobody in the military wants the F-35, but we keep putting money into it because the defense contractors have greased the right palms.
DOD contractors.
A lot of guys like to talk about the military because that seems to be a guy thing. But Amber, let me hear from you on this. Is our military strong enough? Is it focused in the right direction? Are we spending too much?
When I think of the military, my first thought is that I sleep like a baby at night. And I know that there are a lot of people in a lot of places around the world where they don't get to do that. So for that reason alone, I say, yes, we have to be doing the right thing and we have to be in the right direction, because look at how sound and safe we all feel. And also, to me, the military, I know that there are the weapons and there are the wars, but I think of the people and the families. And so I'm more so concerned about how we treat our veterans, how we're treating them when they come back, when they're wounded, the families that are, that we're, how we're supporting those families well when they're away.
That's another thing that Donald Trump talked about a second ago. And I have to keep hearkening back to Donald Trump, but he says a lot of things. And he says that we're treating our veterans miserably, and it's a disgrace. I mean, I think he's absolutely right about that. When you look at the situation of the VA hospitals, how can we, in good conscience, send 10 years of men and women to war and not provide for them when they get back adequately?
That's what we have. We have to do a better job. I think that that, to me, is way more important than whatever weapon we're using or not using. We have got to be able to look our veterans in the eye when they're walking down the street, and we need to be able to look their children in the eye when their parents are overseas. And right now, I can't comfortably do that.
Well, it's not your fault.
It is my fault. It is my fault.
We're on the cusp of spending $1 trillion on medical care for the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's unfathomable. We talk about deficits. My new friend Duncan over here brought that up. That comes into deficits and the national debt. Again, I'd hate to keep harping back on it. We need to have a different narrative on our foreign policy so that our foreign policy isn't getting us into hot wars. We can win hot wars. It's the wars that we're looking at now, war on terrorism, that is a difficult one to win.
We've got all the issues with the lone wolf attacks. How does a conventional military stop lone wolf attacks?
Exactly.
It doesn't.
Good point.
Is our presence in the Middle East making us more secure, or is it making us less so?
Well,
I would say it's definitely more insecure. I mean, to some extent, I think we have to be there. But we're always there because something we did before didn't work out. And, you know, we supplied weapons in Afghanistan in the 80s, and that ended up turning into the Taliban, and, you know, then we had to go back and fight them again. We gave weapons to Saddam to fight the Iranians, and then they got used against us when we went in Iraq.
Which tells you what?
It tells we're a little too short-sighted, and we can't just go after, you know, what we see as at the moment being the problem. It's like we got to think about the bigger and broader problem in the Middle East and why it is the way it was, and I'm not sure what that solution is, but we've got to try something else.
There are those who say we will never understand it because we don't really understand the politics of it and the religious nature of it, and we don't understand the culture, we don't understand the history. Is it time for us to ask powers in that part of the world to take care of their own problems? This seems to be a Shia, Sunni war. Something that we really don't understand. Is it time for us to say, you handle this?
I think to some extent, a lot of the problems we have in the Middle East is because of the way we cut it up after World War I. And, you know, we drew lines, and then there was people on, you know, Sunni and Shia on different sides. So we started creating these problems. I think we're already seeing them work themselves out a little bit, but it's not going to be pretty.
Could a presidential candidate win an election by saying it's time for them to handle this and we need to back off? Or will that just lose the election for them?
I don't think anybody wants to be involved in the Middle East. I think a lot of us feel we have to be, because if we're not, things could spin out of control very quickly and then we could get drawn back into it anyway. You know, if one of these countries – well, we know Pakistan is nuclear, but if a nuclear bomb goes off in Jerusalem – we're dragged right back into it. So I think a lot of the politicians or Washington or the military feel like we have to be there to try and keep a lid on it, with obviously not a great deal of success thus far.
Has the foreign policy, as some Republicans have said, the foreign policy of President Obama, has it made us weak, or has it shown the rest of the world that we're not trying to bully them?
Well, my thinking is that Obama's approach has been refreshing from his predecessor. I think what I'd like to see a foreign policy that looks very much like the recent Iran deal. It's a combination of Teddy Roosevelt's walk softly and carry a big stick and Captain Kangaroo walking around with a bunch of carrots in his pocket. I think we need a combination of sticks and carrots, but with the emphasis on the carrots.
But some leading Republicans have said that was a disaster, that we should not be making friends with our enemies, that we should show them who's boss, essentially.
Again, the Republicans, no matter what Obama does, are going to take the opposite side. Like I said earlier, if Obama found a cure for cancer this morning, the Republicans would be accusing him of putting doctors out of work this afternoon.
And, Josh, you have asked, you know who's had a good foreign policy? Me neither.
It just never seems to work out. And there's all these things that happen that we don't foresee happening.
And when you say it never seems to work out, are you referring specifically to the Middle East? Or are you referring to our foreign policy structure overall?
I think mostly talking about the Middle East. I think we have some problems, obviously, in Asia as well. But what is good, and Bob, right, you said we will never go to war with China. I don't think we will, because we are so economically tied to them now.
Yeah.
And it's never going to turn into a war. So I don't think we do a lot of the right posturing with Asia either, but it's working out better there. So.
And Duncan, I don't know that you agree with Josh on this, because you have said that after years of letting Europe and Russia take the lead, it's time for America to lead again. Explain that.
Well, I think President Obama's foreign policy has made us weaker. I don't think a lot of things have gotten better. The migrant crisis in Europe, I think, shows that, where the Middle East has really, you know, we had Egypt fall, we had Libya fall. Granted, Gaddafi getting out of power wasn't a bad thing, but it's gotten more dangerous over there. It's kind of the devil we don't know.
What started it all?
I think it was increasing food prices, because if you can't feed your family, you get very angry.
It wasn't our toppling of Saddam Hussein. That was the first domino.
Yeah, Saddam was the sheriff of the Middle East.
Yeah, but
and whether we liked him or not, he did a pretty good job of sheriffing the Middle East.
I don't think he had that much power, but that may have been the first domino. That was a domino that was going to fall anyway. He was, what, 68? He wasn't going to live forever, and I think a lot of these problems were coming. But I think at the same time, we stepped back, kind of let Europe and Russia take the lead. And if you give Vladimir Putin a chance to take the lead, he's going to take it. And I think that Russia's behind a lot of these things. And, you know, Saudi Arabia hasn't taken a single asylum seeker, even though they're right there and have plenty of money. I think that America taking a back seat in a lot of these. Granted, I don't want to be the only one out there, but I think we are less secure now.
Let's move to something more domestic for the moment. Let's go to let's talk about religion for a second. In this campaign, we've heard that Christians are under attack and that we should stop the flow of Muslims into the United States until we can identify more accurately those who mean us harm. So let's talk about these very different issues. Is Christianity under attack in the United States, Amber?
Under attack by who? I don't even understand that whole line of reasoning. I think that America is still a place where we welcome all religions and we allow people to practice however they want to practice in the open. How can Christianity be under attack when no one is telling you that you can't have your church or you can't have your religious beliefs? I don't even know what that is about.
Josh.
I understand how people can feel that it's under attack when, you know, especially when social policy starts changing. I don't think it's really as much to do with religion as it is people's, you know, the way they grew up and the, you know, the things that they learned and the things that they believe.
What
and
you're saying
when
is
those start changing.
So you're saying that things like gay marriage,
correct,
makes Christians feel as though they're being attacked.
Yeah.
Why does that equate?
It doesn't really for me. I don't think that it equates at all. And, you know, gay marriage is an issue that a lot of people, a lot of religious people are not happy with. And so they're going to feel like things are changing and they're going to be angry and they're going to think that Christianity is under attack, even though there's nothing about that in our laws that said that it had to be that way.
Let's hear from the other Republican in the room. Duncan.
No, Christianity is not under attack.
Okay.
It's just not.
Bob.
But it does get ratings.
Yeah, it's good. It's good rhetoric.
It gets ratings.
Good
and when
rhetoric
you're having a political
it
rally,
votes.
It gets people to cheer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I find even though my tendencies tend to be Democratic. The Republicans that I know, the things that they're saying to me across the table and on the streets are very different than what I'm hearing from these people on television or in these far out places. And I'm having a hard time even reconciling. I'm like, are you even from the same party? Because you standing in front of me are saying things that I can understand, or I can understand your point of view. Maybe I don't agree, but it makes sense to me. These people over here are saying things that sound like insanity, and I can't even unpack what they're saying.
And that's how I feel too. I'm like, yeah. Who is supporting these people?
Like your neighbor getting, you know, being in a gay marriage doesn't affect your religion at all.
So, Bob, we're sitting here listening to three. We're older than the rest of these people in the room.
Oh, wait a minute.
And we're sitting here listening to them talk about things, and that's all well and good. But you were around before the primary system took hold in this country. And the primary system tends to make candidates it forces them to play to the extremes of their base in both parties. Is that what's causing this? To get elected, you have to be extreme, or you're going to lose to somebody else. And therefore, the country has gotten into loggerheads where we just can't get anything done.
You hit the nail right on the head, Mike. What we have here is a situation where we got a ball game going on in Washington, D.C., and they have to keep us separated, and they have to divide and conquer us, because it's a very expensive ball game. It costs the American people over $7 million a day just to unlock the Capitol, whether anything gets done or not. And a lot of that comes from private contributions. It costs, for the average congressman, $2,300 a day he's got to raise just to keep in that seat. For a senator, it's much worse. It's over $10,000. I heard Tom Daschle say it was $15,000. Well, my research says it's $10,400. That's a lot of money that you have to come up with every day. So at the end of the day, no one is going to bed hungry in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the American people have been duped out of another $7 million to get nothing done. So.
There's a lot of concern about immigration. There's a lot of concern about the Muslim immigration, because that's being fueled by the San Bernardino and Paris, et cetera. But, Josh, you say that you don't blame people for coming here illegally. You understand that they want a better life, but you would prefer to limit them to what we can or should take on. That's what an immigration system is for. And everybody, I've done many shows on this with experts on immigration and legal people and political people, and every one of them to a person says, our immigration system is broken. And this has been going on for 30 years. No one wants to fix it. Why not?
I don't know. That's a great question. And it's – we've been – wanting immigration reform for years, and it keeps kind of threatening to happen, and it never does. And I'm not sure why we can't, I think we should control our border, and but I don't care I'm fine to let people in, but I just want to know who's here, and I want to make it easier for people to get here, and I don't know why that can't happen.
Do any of you worry that so many people are coming in here illegally, and do you worry that if we let some of these Muslim refugees in, the peace-loving Muslim refugees in, that our way of life is threatened? Because some people do feel that their cultural heritage, their American identity is on the line with these people coming in. Do you fear that?
I think it is American identity to have immigration here. We're a nation of immigrants.
That's Duncan, the Republican, yes, saying that.
Okay. I'm the child of immigrants. My parents immigrated here in the 60s. We need a functional immigration system where people can come here. And I don't think I've ever been more disappointed in the Republican Party than their reaction to the refugees. Mm. I think that they were playing the race card and trying to get people frightened. And I was just very disappointed.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the economy, about the labor market. I want to talk about the media as well. Everybody wants to talk about the media and bash them. We're coming right back. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, committed to providing collaborative legal solutions to the business community. Offices in Charlotte, Rock Hill, and the Research Triangle, RobinsonBradshaw.com. Well, scientists say that global temperatures in 2015 were the hottest on record, smashing the 2014 record, also the hottest on record to that date, by a wide margin. What the warming of the planet could mean for weather patterns, climate policy, and hitting global temperature targets. That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We will continue our conversation with our voter roundtable. And if you'd like to get your 2 cents worth in, you can at charlottetalks@wfae.org or by searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro in Washington, D.C.
And this is Kelly McEvers in Culver City, California.
And people listening to the show might not know that in front of each of us, there is a red phone.
Kind of like that phone that must be in the president's office, right?
Except this is so that in the middle of the show, when news breaks, Kelly and I can talk about how we can give you the most relevant of the moment show anywhere.
Are you sure it's only for when news breaks?
Okay, sometimes it's also for gossip. Join us every afternoon on All Things Considered.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're having our voter roundtable today in conjunction with NPR. And we have around us at the table two independents, a Democrat and Republican. Josh Fahey is an independent and conservative whose politics lean libertarian. Socially liberal, usually votes Republican. Amber Logan is in the real estate industry and is a Democrat but has changed her affiliation or will be changing her affiliation to independent so she can vote in the primaries the way she wants to. Bob Harrison is a retired teacher and a 60s radical, a lifelong activist, a registered independent, unhappy with both parties. Duncan Wilson is a financial planner and attorney who has been a registered Republican since the age of 18, but he too is disappointed with the GOP. 8 years ago, the world economy was in shambles. It was the worst crisis since the Great Depression. Since then, the automobile industry has been saved. The stock market is back. Home sales are up. Prices in the home industry are up. Am I right about that, Amber?
I believe so. I do commercial, but
okay.
Yes.
The consumer economy has revived. Unemployment is down. And yet many, many, many people simply don't see or feel any of this. Why not?
Because it costs so much more and everyone's making so much less.
Wages haven't grown. Not for the middle class. It used to be that the people at the bottom were getting squeezed, and that has moved up. You know, I think it's over half of millennials don't have $1,000 in the bank.
Right.
And that means when their clutch goes out, when their air conditioning breaks, something like that, that's going on a credit card. And that's an entire generation.
And they have student loan debts that
the
they started
student loans,
with. Exactly.
The millennials will be the first generation that's worse off than their parents. And I don't see a way to undo that at this point.
Well, what about Bernie Sanders' suggestion that college be free?
That would be great if we had a giant bucket of money.
But don't fall for it. I'm from California. When I was growing up, college was pretty much free. Community college was $50 a semester, and the state college was free. But you know what? Books weren't free.
Yeah.
Fees weren't free. Housing certainly wasn't free. And you have to remember that when you're a full-time student, you're not earning a living. And so it's not just the tuition amount. To make college free, you have to really put a lot into it. You have to create an entire system. You can't just eliminate tuition.
Yeah. I think Bernie is talking about the right issues. I think he's one of the few that's talking about the right issues. But I don't love his solutions. But he is talking about the right problems.
He's a socialist.
Yes.
He self-identifies as a socialist.
We're all socialists, Mike.
Well, how so?
Have you driven on interstate highway? You're a socialist.
Okay.
You go to public school?
You're socialist.
Okay.
So does that
just
does
get
the,
that behind us?
Does the, as a Republican, does that frighten you that a socialist could go to the White House?
You know, potentially, but it's not like he's going to get anything through Congress anyway. But I like that he's talking about the right issues.
Plus, there's a bunch of executive orders.
Well, yeah.
Well, if we have a conversation, we can possibly solve some things, right?
Yeah.
He brings the issue up, and we all work together to solve it, and we can move forward.
Education.
Bingo.
Education inflation has outpaced almost everything. The cost of going to college nowadays is absolutely astronomical. And the blame lies so many places. It's with the schools. It's with the government for making free money free to the school with the student loans. You know, you can borrow up to $30,000 a year. And isn't it weird that so many schools charge $30,000 a year?
How about that, huh?
That's weird.
Some have said that part of the problem is that we're living through the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution, where everything changed, where people went from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy, where skills that heretofore, like blacksmithing, was something that could keep you in bread and other necessities. You couldn't do that anymore when automobiles came in during the Industrial Revolution. Is that what's happening now with this information economy and computerization and robots?
I mean, I think so. I think we're going to move to a more automated world. And I think that's scary to a lot of people. I'm not necessarily scared by it. I think we'll find new economies or new jobs out there.
But it's uncomfortable in the interim.
Yep. Knew a kid going into college right now and he was trying to figure out what to do, I wouldn't know what to tell him.
Exactly. Yeah. I have my 15-year-old behind me here who is very awesome in so many ways, but that's the one thing that I have been up nights about, because I don't know what to tell her as far as preparing for the future, because it's just it's a black box to me right now.
And yet, Josh, you say it's a responsibility of young people to get the training they'll need for the jobs of the future. And even you say you don't know what those jobs are.
Well, if you do well at math and you continue in that path, you're probably going to do all right.
Yeah.
Is our education system preparing kids today for the world of tomorrow?
No.
I believe that in America, we know how to educate everyone. We just don't. And I don't know why we play this game. There are a lot of children that we continue to refuse to educate. And there are a few children that we've always educated well, and we're doing a very great job with them. And that's something that we have to decide as a nation that we're going to be differently. But we have great teachers that are definitely wanting to do it, but we put things in their way to make it difficult for them to teach. And we are... some days we want to teach children, and other days we just want to get them through the system. And that's not going to get them where they need to be so they can compete on a world market.
Well, to take off on what Amber's saying, we have the wrong approach. We have, in inner cities, we have a lot of underperforming schools. We have assigned letter grades to them, A, B, C, D, E, F. Some of them are doing an excellent job, and they get a grade of D or F. So they get punished. You would think that what we would do if we have an underperforming school, that we would, rather than punish them, we would be more supportive of them. It seems what we're doing is we're taking the money out of public schools to support underperforming schools, and we're giving them too much to charter schools that are really not producing any better results in terms of education.
I would disagree. I think charter schools are doing a fantastic job, and it's creating school choice.
That's not what the statistics show.
That's the European model.
Well, in the United States, our charter schools are doing no better than our public schools. I don't think that's arguable.
And I started my daughter in a charter school and moved her out of that, because when I got in there, the thing that I learned is that school is more than putting on – it's more complicated than putting on a show in the barn. They were under-resourced. They were making it up as they were going along. And I felt that, you know what? Maybe she needs to be a part of a system that's got a track record, as opposed to some people with some great ideas that they're changing every 6 months. So
I think the charter schools as a system, at least in North Carolina, it's still very new. And I think the great charter schools are doing a fantastic job. I'm on the – full disclosure, I'm on the board of a charter school.
Thank you for the full disclosure there.
The ones that are doing great are fantastic. If you're at an underfunded one where it's just a group of people that didn't bring a lot of funding to the table, then it's going to be very hard to succeed.
But isn't that true for our public schools? Isn't that true for our independent schools? I believe that we should all really put our energy and focus into a few solutions and focus on what works, and not continue to drain from the ones that are suffering.
I think the system's been so bad for so long that it's okay to try another system.
Education is really a local issue, although people rail against the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. Do any candidates at any level, are any of them addressing the issue of education in a way that you think might make a difference?
Bernie Sanders.
Well, there's the conversation of, you know, no child left behind and leave no children on the bus, or whatever the newest catchphrase that they have.
There's the new one now. Why do you say Bernie Sanders?
Well, he's talking about making college education free, and at least first 2 years. That's a step in the right direction.
But you have to be adequately prepared for college to take advantage of that. Are we doing that?
That takes us back to the last conversation we had about our primary schools and our secondary schools. We have a lot of work to do there. I agree with Amber. We should take the things that work and support them, and the things that don't work, we should chuck them.
Because if we can put a man on the moon, surely we can educate all of our children.
So let's talk about the media for 10 seconds, because I think it was you, Duncan, who said ratings drive a lot of this political conversation that we have. How would you describe the coverage the media is giving to the presidential campaign?
It's I think we're living in a new era of yellow journalism, the same that we saw at the turn of the 20th century. I think we're seeing it again today because we've got echo chambers. You can hear what you want to hear. You can find anyone that's going to agree with you. You know, Republicans watch Fox, Democrats watch MSNBC, mm-hmm. and people in waiting rooms watch CNN.
or Fox.
And so you get this, and it's a constant hype machine, and you can just get people who agree with you, so you're more emboldened in your beliefs because, well, that expert right there believes it agrees with me.
Well, some of you were particularly critical of the media, particularly the big media. Some of you have said have referred to the liberal mainstream media. I'd like to get a definition of that and whether or not you include NPR in that. And do you make a delineation between network television news, cable news, the print media? Is there a difference in your mind, or is it all the same machine?
Print media is the best. It's awesome because I enjoy it. I read the newspaper every day. I get the long form. I supplement that with what I hear on the radio. Listen to NPR all the time. And then I still believe in the importance of a nightly news cycle or the Sunday news for the Meet the Press and those kinds of things.
Well, things like Meet the Press, Face the Nation, this week with George Stephanopoulos, are they biased?
I think everything is always biased, which is why you have to have a little bit from everything. So that way you can get yourself a balanced meal by having all these bites from different places.
How much of the problem of this bifurcation of left versus right in the media and people saying that the media is treating it all unfairly is due to the fact that we have a limited media education, that a lot of people have gravitated, as somebody said at this table, toward the echo chamber. I'm going to watch these people or listen to these people because they're saying what I already believe. They must be right. They must be unbiased. How much of it is due to that? How much of it is due to simply that we don't understand how to use the media? Some people don't understand that Fox News, I can't understand this could be possible, but it is, that Fox News is to the right and that MSNBC is to the left. They just don't know that.
Or maybe they don't care.
Yeah, I think it could be that they just don't care. It's all theater. I mean, even Meet the Press, it's all just theater. There's so much media coaching that these people go through that they already know what they're going to say before the question is asked. And that's why I miss Tim Russert so much because
yes.
He could cut through the theater.
Oh, yeah.
He was so good. And since then, there hasn't been someone that's really replaced him in that high profile of a position.
For my generation, it was Walter Cronkite.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders says that our election system is corrupt. Citizens United has given too much power to rich people to pick and choose politicians who will serve them. Congress and state legislators have been able to gerrymander districts so that they can choose their voters. How do you fix that when the people who have to fix it are the people who benefit from the way it is today? Well, I haven't heard from you in a long time, Josh.
I don't know. That's a major problem. I've talked about term limits too. It's like that would be a great thing to do too. But it's the people that are in power are the ones that have to change those laws. And I guess the only way to do it is to bring in people that are saying that they are going to change that, but nobody's saying. It's not even a conversation that's on the table.
Duncan, you're in the financial industry. You're a Republican, and you say that large corporations have pretty much bought the system and that the super PAC system seems intentionally opaque.
Yes.
Would other Republicans agree with you?
I think the silent majority would. You know, if you look at Hillary Clinton's donors, the biggest ones are all Wall Street. And she's supposed to be a Democrat. And she's against Glass-Steagall coming back. There is no good reason to be against Glass-Steagall and putting up the wall between retail and investment banks. The only reason to be against that is if you owe people on Wall Street. The fact that we can't see who's donating to super PACs, why can't we see that? I think it's.
Do you think they're doing any good, though? It feels like just a massive amount of spending.
This year? No, they're not doing any good at all. I mean, they're all giving the. They gave a ton of money to Jeb, and that's not exactly working out.
Yeah. It's interesting that when Citizens United was decided that Justice Kennedy later said, well, we thought Congress would come along and fix that in terms of putting in disclosure. But I think he was very short-sighted in thinking that Congress would or could do anything to fix Citizens United. So
I think a lot of these
love to know who's spending the money and for whom.
I think a lot of these big problems, certainly term limits, the only way I know to fix it is a constitutional convention. And I know the Texas legislature is having that conversation. I don't know how to cut through Washington any other way to get term limits to fix a lot of the structural issues.
Duncan is 100% right. This is the only way we're going to be able to.
Doesn't the idea of a constitutional convention scare you quickly?
Yes, because you're putting a lot of things on the table.
A lot of things on the table. All right. We have less than 2 minutes left, so let's go around the table. If you had to vote today, who would you vote for president? Amber.
If I had to vote today, who would I vote for president? You know,
quickly.
I'm going to go with Sanders.
All right. Bernie Sanders. Josh.
I'm not happy with anybody, but I would probably go with Marco Rubio if I could, even though I disagree with him on several issues. But I think he would be a decent choice.
Bob.
All I can say is feel the burn.
So two for Bernie. Hillary's not doing well around this table, because I know that, Duncan, you're not going to vote for Hillary. So who would you vote for?
John Kasich, because he's balanced the budget in Ohio and Washington.
And which of the candidates do you think have been the most substantive on issues, whether or not you agree with them? Quickly, Duncan.
On my side, Kasich, and on the other, Bernie.
Probably Rand Paul. And Bernie, I mean, they both believe what they're saying. I just don't agree with them.
I hate to do two on one side, but I think that the Democratic candidates have been very receptive across the board.
Okay. And?
I'm going to have to agree with Duncan. It's just I'm going to flip them.
Okay. And flip them quickly. Which way?
Well, he would agree with Kasich and Bernie. I just would go with Bernie and Kasich in that order.
Bob Harrison, retired independent. Duncan Wilson, a Republican, financial planner, attorney, not happy with the GOP. Amber Logan, a Democrat, voting independent. And Josh Fahey, an independent-leaning Republican. Very interesting. Thank you all for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.